Views and opinions expressed by the hosts are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of their employers. This podcast may not be suitable for children. Adults may find details triggering and/or offensive. Listener's discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. This is Norma.
And this is Priscilla.
And you're listening to
It's the Mystery for Me. Back to another episode of It's the Mystery for Me. As mentioned last episode, Norma is hosting this week's episode, but before we get to her case, we just want to make a little announcement. And we made this announcement already on our Instagram page, but we are going to be altering the schedule. When we say that, we mean when episodes come out. And we think that an every other week schedule would work best for us. Especially considering our outside commitments. And we always just want to give you guys the best and well-researched episodes possible. And we also want to make sure we're being consistent. One of the constructive criticisms we've gotten is that we're not always consistent with episode drops. And So we're definitely like paying attention to this feedback. Aside from outside commitments, sometimes things are just happening in the background that we can't really speak on because it's not our place to speak on it, but there's things that affect us both personally, just life events that if you guys heard what those things were, I think you would be like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, you know? Mm-hmm. Me personally, sometimes just with my mental health, things can just feel overwhelming for me. So I've been trying to find a balance forever when it comes to that. I think the other side of this is also that these stories are very morbid and heavy, and I also didn't realize how heavy it would be going into it, because I went from being like just somebody who kind of watched true crime here and there to someone who was constantly reading about true crime 24/7. So That has been an adjustment. We saw this as a hobby. And so that's kind of like where it was in our mind. But as we went on and saw how important it became to people, I mean, it really shocked us In the best way. But it also puts a lot of pressure on us because it stops feeling like a hobby and starts feeling like a job, right? And Like in a job environment, if you don't show up to work, you get fired, right? Like, so that's kind of why we're like, all right, the way this has gone, I guess we kind of have to start treating it like a job in the sense that, okay, let's figure out where we can improve and tackle those areas. And I think one of those areas happens to be consistency. And hopefully, you know, this new schedule will help us. I did see someone comment asking us if we could just film everything maybe in one day and then kind of put it out slowly. But it takes a lot of time to research each case. We spend at least like 8 hours.
Oh, yeah.
At least researching a case, Combing the internet, looking at court documents. That doesn't include the time that we sit and record. That's another, let's say, an hour and a half. So we're cutting down a lot of that because you guys are getting like 45 minutes or Sometimes an hour. But we could record for way longer than that.
Yeah. The editing process, I know for me, it can be very long.
It can take forever. When I'm editing an episode, it takes me around, I would say, 2.5 hours to edit the actual track.
For me, when I started editing, it took me probably 7 hours.
Yeah. I mean, you live and you learn, Norma. Jeez. Now She's edited plenty of episodes, So it doesn't take her that long. But there's a lot of time being spent. So I guess doing one case, including editing and putting everything out, takes probably anywhere from 10 to 15 hours Of work.
Yeah.
I wish it was as easy as just filming everything in one day or something, or like kind of dividing it up. But you just never know what's going to be happening that week in general with work, with this or that. So it becomes a little bit complicated. But doing something every other week, that gives us room to kind of breathe and also make sure we're taking care of our other commitments and ourselves while also delivering the kind of content we want to, right? These are stories we want people to hear and know about so that we can raise awareness about these cases. We are approaching our 3-year anniversary in June, and we're not saying that we will never go back to a weekly schedule. Like, we might go back to a weekly schedule, honestly. It's just right now, I think this is what works best until we can make sure we can actually commit to that for y'all. If you guys have any other suggestions, feel free to leave us a comment on Instagram under the post where we announce like what's happening and the schedule changing, or DM us, email us, whatever you think, we read it. So, and with that, we'll go ahead and turn to this week's episode.
So for today's episode, I watched an episode of a show called Nightmare Next Door, and that is season 6, episode 5. I also looked at a few articles and websites like Buffalo News, True Activist, and the Erie County District Attorney's Office official website.
Buffalo, that's interesting. We were just in Buffalo for a sister's trip / business event for me. Well, either way, for a full list of today's sources, please check out our website, isthemysteryforme.com, or click the link in today's show notes.
This story takes us back to 1994 in Buffalo, New York. This is a case of Cynthia Epps. Cynthia Epps was born in 1964 or 1965, although I could not find an exact date of birth. In 1994, she was 29 years old and living in the east side of Buffalo, New York. Cynthia is described as someone who was always smiling and joyful. She has a sister, Roxanne, who makes an appearance on the show, and it seems that she has other siblings based on a Buffalo News article, but it's unclear how many of them there are total. Cynthia especially enjoyed reading, going to concerts, and was into fashion. In her younger years, she was an honor roll student and went on to graduate as a cosmetologist. She loved doing hair. Her specialty was doing braids and adding beads at the end. Remember, this is the 90s.
I love that. Hey, it's coming back.
Yeah, it is coming back. By 1994, Cynthia was a mother of two to her 7-year-old and 1-year-old daughters. She also had a 31-year-old boyfriend by the name of Carter Rayner, although it was unclear how long they had been dating for. But that is pretty much all the information I could find about Cynthia, so let's just jump into the day in question.
Well, is Carter the father of either of her kids?
No.
Okay.
So Cynthia's sister, Roxanne, is enjoying an early morning breakfast on Thursday, June 30th, 1994, when Cynthia's boyfriend Carter stops by unannounced. He tells Roxanne that Cynthia is missing. Just for context, Cynthia lived close by to her sister, like down the block, and they had apparently always lived close by to each other their entire lives.
How much older is Roxanne, or how old is Roxanne?
Currently, Roxanne is in her 60s, so 5 to 10 years.
Older?
Yeah.
So she's an older sister, gotcha.
Apparently, Cynthia went out for a walk the night before, June 29th, 1994, and she did not return home. Carter began looking for her immediately, but he couldn't find her. He was visibly in distress, and he seemed genuinely worried, according to Roxanne. Carter did end up calling the cops to report Cynthia missing right before dropping by Roxanne's house, so cops are beginning to patrol the neighborhood at this point.
So, wait a minute. She's been missing since the night before?
Yes.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now is when he's calling the cops. Okay.
Then that morning at about 9 a.m., a call comes in to 911 reporting an abandoned cabinet. A man by the name of James Fountain, who lived in the neighborhood, had found an abandoned small cabinet in his backyard.
Wait, like an actual cabinet? Like, from the kitchen?
That's what I was thinking, too. It turns out to be more of like a dresser cabinet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes more sense.
James is audibly distraught. James and his friend, Ted, were doing some renovations on James' home that morning and noticed the cabinet in the middle of the backyard.
He became distraught because he saw a cabinet.
Can I, like,
continue talking? Well, you said talking? That he's distraught. That's yeah. why I'm like...
I mean, I'm going to say why.
Okay.
So it was an odd discovery, but they just figured they'll discard it. But when they tried to lift up the small cabinet, it was heavier than they expected, and one of the doors popped open. And inside, they saw a woman's head poking out of a green blanket. The woman was unresponsive, so that is why they called 911. When officers arrive at the scene, they make a grisly discovery. They find a black female with stab wounds to her chest and upper abdomen. The victim is unfortunately deceased on the scene, and the victim's head was also partially decapitated. Whoa. So the Buffalo Police Department homicide unit is immediately notified because it appears to be a homicide. What they noticed is that there was very little blood inside the cabinet. It looked as though whoever had done this allowed this victim to bleed out before placing them in the cabinet.
Gotcha.
So all the blood was dried up and they were wrapped, put in this blanket, and then placed inside this cabinet. It does not take long for detectives to determine that the woman in the cabinet was Cynthia Epps. Cynthia's body is immediately taken for the medical examiner to determine the exact cause of her death. In the meantime, detectives are trying to figure out who would want to hurt Cynthia. Was it a random attack or was it someone that she knew?
Wait, whose backyard did she get found in?
This man by the name of James.
Okay, who called 911. Someone random, right?
Someone
right,
random.
Right. Gotcha. For a second, I was like, I thought it was in Carter's backyard or something.
No.
Does James live nearby?
James lives in the neighborhood. I don't know how close by he lives in proximity to Roxanne, her sister, or Cynthia.
Gotcha. But in the neighborhood, I mean, that's close.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, again, detectives are trying to figure out who would want to hurt Cynthia. Why would they place her body in a cabinet / dresser and place it in James' backyard? It just didn't make sense. Well, apparently James' backyard was connected to an abandoned property. So it basically created an alleyway. And it was known for drug addicts to use this alleyway. So this makes the search even more difficult for detectives because it could really be anyone that dumped Cynthia's body in James's backyard. When the news breaks that Cynthia was found murdered, her sister Roxanne and her family are completely devastated. They can't understand who would want to hurt Cynthia. They don't think that she has any enemies. It's just very random to them. As far as the neighbors, they're in a panic because they're just thinking, who is a sadistic killer just putting a person in a cabinet? This is so random. Are they capable of doing this again?
Well, what kind of neighborhood was it?
It seemed like it was a pretty quiet, tight-knit community.
That's the words that are used in every crime show.
Right, but that's what they said.
But what's the crime rate like in Buffalo?
So today, Buffalo has one of the highest homicide rates in the U.S., that may have been true in 1994, but I can't say for sure because I couldn't find any records from 1994.
Noted.
So the next day on July 1st, 1994, the autopsy report comes in. Yes, they're moving very, very quickly. I think just based on the circumstances of the crime, they want to just put everyone's mind at ease. It reveals that Cynthia was stabbed once in the chest, and that went through her heart, and that was her official cause of death.
I was watching a documentary last night about this guy who, I don't know, he was a hitman for the mafia. But I'm pretty sure it was in that documentary that they were talking about how people who stab people, like, it's a very personal way to kill somebody.
Mm.
And I don't think he stabbed people a lot. He used other methods, but I'm just saying, like, in this case, she was stabbed to death.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, at least it punctured her heart, which killed her.
Yeah.
Which, I guess I'm just thinking maybe it's somebody she knows.
Maybe. So, Cynthia was also found nude from the waist up. And she had on maroon pants, but underneath the pants there was no underwear. So, to detectives, it looks like she was sexually assaulted. And this was also different than what her boyfriend, Carter, reported her wearing. Now, exactly what he told them she was wearing, I'm not sure. On the show, the reenactment looked like she was wearing some sort of tracksuit. When the medical examiners removed her pants, they noticed that Cynthia's leg was cut almost in half. Yet, there were no slash marks on the actual pants. So, they think that whoever did this was trying to dismember her. It likely was not working, and they just put the pants on her after the fact. And same thing with, like, the gash on her neck. That pretty much aligned with her being partially decapitated as well. So whoever was doing this, the blade wasn't sharp enough to cut through. And it looks like they just gave up.
Or did they become so repulsed by what they did that they were just like, I can't believe I did this.
Perhaps. Both of those cut wounds were done post-mortem. Mm. Samples of bodily fluids were also taken from Cynthia's body. But remember, DNA was not really advanced in 1994 as it is now. So it's hard to know back then what would come out of that sample.
I think they were just gathering samples back in the day because they knew this type of technology would eventually be available.
Yeah.
And they could test it for other things at that point in time. They might not be able to link it to a person through, like, the CODA system, but mm-hmm. maybe they could tell you some characteristics about the person, whether they're, like, male or female, whether, you know,
yeah,
different things.
Mm-hmm. So detectives do the best they can with what they have so far. And they think it's best to talk to the two men that found the cabinet, James Fountain and Ted Bromine. So Ted had an arrest record dating back to 1962 for various charges, most of which were robbery and assault. He tells detectives that he went over to help James with renovations on June 30th, 1994. And James told him about a box in the backyard. When Ted saw a person inside the box, which turned out to be the small cabinet, he initially thought this person was a drunk. You know, where James's house is, behind it is an abandoned home, and it's known that drug addicts use that as an alleyway. So he just figured, oh, this is a drunk. So he initially tries to wake this person up, but they were unresponsive. He told detectives that James seemed nervous and wanted to leave. He didn't want police to search his property, and he was afraid that this would look bad on him. And I'm just thinking, well, there is a dead body in your backyard in a cabinet. This looks really crazy, and of course you're going to be a target of investigation. So I could see why he would be nervous. And again, like, this is not Ted's house. I'm sure if it were reversed, Ted would feel differently, right. I think.
Right. I mean, we've seen cops get people put away who are innocent, mm-hmm. right? And so maybe he has seen some true crime documentaries at this point, and he's thinking, yeah, I don't want that to be my outcome, especially if I didn't do it.
Yeah. But Ted is able to convince James to call the police and said it would look worse if they try to leave the scene. When he was asked where he was the night before, Ted does not have an alibi. So this looks really suspicious because how can you not remember where you were and what you were doing the night before?
Oh, he literally couldn't remember.
Yes, he couldn't.
I thought you were going to say that he was at home and no one could verify that. Oh, is Ted a drunk? Or is Ted someone who is, was he on some sort of substance is what I'm trying to say. Was Ted having him a good time?
I think that this will, your question will be answered later on.
Okay.
And I think it'll shock you.
Okay. yeah, in my head. I'm just, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just kind of confused right now.
Yeah, I was confused too. But they don't have anything on Ted to hold him at this point, so they just let him go. But obviously, he's still on their list. So James is questioned next, and James is described as a 37-year-old short man that was shy and wore glasses. He was super cooperative, and he answered all their questions. James tells them that he is new to Buffalo, and he actually moved there to be closer to family. As far as an alibi, James said that he was with his sister the night before, and his sister is able to confirm that. James said that after he left his sister's house at night, he went home, he cooked dinner, and he fell asleep. Detectives search his home, and they don't find anything. He seems to not have a record, and there's no evidence to link him to the crime. So at this point, detectives find him believable, and they let James go.
How did they describe Ted and his looks? Because we know that James is a short king.
Mm-hmm.
What about Ted?
They don't give a description on Ted.
Nothing? Did you find anything, like how old he was at the time?
No.
Interesting.
So now detectives look into Carter Rayner, who's Cynthia's boyfriend. Could he have something to do with it? So Roxanne is adamant that Carter loved her sister and he would never hurt her. She didn't believe that Carter had anything to do with Cynthia's murder. Carter is described as soft-spoken. He appeared to really be genuine and just concerned about Cynthia's murder.
Wait a minute. So they are describing Carter on the show. They describe the short king, James, but they're not describing Ted? I'm a visual person. I need to know. What does Ted look like? How old is Ted? It's just interesting that they are describing everyone else but Ted, but keep going. It's just something that I'm thinking about.
Okay. So Carter was very upset, obviously, about this whole murder, and he was willing to help in any way that he could. Like James, he was very cooperative and he answered all their questions, and he didn't appear nervous at all. But then it comes out that their relationship was a little rocky and they argued a bit. So detectives are now wondering, well, is this why Cynthia left her house at night for a walk? Because she was trying to cool off after getting into a fight with Carter. He tells detectives that he saw Cynthia leave the house and he went out to go look for her at around 2 a.m.
Didn't she leave way earlier than that?
Mm-hmm.
What time did you say she left?
They didn't say an official time, but it was late at night. So this means that he went a few hours after she left.
So she maybe left at 10 or 11. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So he didn't go immediately to look for her like he told Roxanne that he did. So could Carter have found Cynthia at around 2 a.m. and heard her? As for an alibi, he doesn't have one. No one knew he was out looking for her. So it doesn't really look good for Carter, but there's nothing to hold him on, so they let Carter go.
Where are her kids?
What do you mean?
Where are her kids in all of this?
They don't go into any details about the kids.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, like, when he goes and looks for her,
mm-hmm.
is he home with the kids? And so he leaves the kids at home. I mean, listen, my parents left us at home all the time. We grew up in the 90s, so.
Yeah.
But one of the kids is like 1 year old, right?
Yeah, so. A 1 year old and a 7 year old. I'm really not sure. It's possible that he left them home alone sleeping. That's what I'm
true.
Thinking.
Yeah, at that point they probably are sleeping. But still.
That's very dangerous.
Yeah.
But again, this is 1994, so.
Right.
You just never know. But again, Carter makes it known that he's willing to help in every way that he can. And detectives take his word for it, and they do keep in touch with him, and they are able to get in touch with him 16 years later.
16 years later?
Yeah.
How did... Okay, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You just kind of threw that in there. You know? 16 years later, so the case went cold?
Yep.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
It is now 2010.
Wow.
And there's a tip that comes in, and it's actually from an attorney that worked for the state attorney general's office, calls detectives and let them know that there's a serial rapist by the name of Mason Sanderson, who was about to be let out of prison, meaning that he was just about done serving his term.
Right.
And this attorney was concerned that Mason would fall back into the same pattern of raping women. Basically, they wanted detectives to look at unsolved crimes around 1994 in the East Buffalo area, and perhaps Mason committed one of those crimes, right? And if there's a match, that's a way to keep Mason in prison.
As long as they're not, like, making up evidence,
right?
I think that's fine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I was thinking that, too.
We don't need Mason out here. Mm-hmm. You know, it don't sound like it, so I don't know.
Now they're thinking, okay, 1994, East Buffalo, could 34-year-old Mason Sanderson be linked to Cynthia's case? So Cynthia was likely sexually assaulted, and Mason raped 8 women in Buffalo's East Side area, which is where Cynthia's from.
Around that time.
Around that time. So he was serving a 12-year sentence. By 2010, he was just at the end of that.
Right.
Detectives are wondering, could Cynthia be one of Mason's victims that were undiscovered?
Did detectives not know about Mason beforehand? Like, was he a suspect?
I don't think he was ever on their radar.
Which is weird, because it's like, it's Buffalo.
What, like, do you mean?
Meaning, it's not such a huge, it's not like a state wide thing. It's like, he committed these crimes in Buffalo.
Yeah.
So were they not privy to that? Were they not trying to put it together? You know what I mean?
I'm not, like, sure. Yeah.
I don't know. That's all. That's what I mean. Like,
yeah, that is, you definitely have a point, because it's such an isolated incident in such, like, a small community that I'm not sure if they looked into that or not. They didn't mention it on the show.
Well, let's see. Once you tell us about Mason and his MO, maybe we'll put two and two together.
Mm-hmm. Detectives now look back at Cynthia's entire profile, and they decide to run her DNA, as DNA has now developed much more since 1994. It is now 2010.
You mean run the DNA they collected off of her?
Yeah. So they submit her DNA hoping for a possible match. And they have Mason's DNA in the system already, because he was in prison and the state already had a sample of his DNA. So they were able to access that easily. But now they have to track down the 3 other men, original suspects, right, to collect their samples. So Carter, James, and Ted.
So you're telling me in 16 years, you know, there's been developments when it comes to DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only now checking it because the attorney general or someone from that office flagged that Mason would be getting out. And now that prompted them to, like, actually run the DNA that they've had all these years?
Yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like.
That is irresponsible work. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of this is tied to, like, lack of funding. And that's why a lot of rape kits and stuff like that are not, you know, processed and whatnot. And they sit in these factories or whatever, these warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've seen it on Law & Order SVU. I believe everything Olivia Benson tells me, okay? But at the same time, having all this stuff in a warehouse is so detrimental to people in society, because a lot of people might be just running free.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be in prison for whatever they did to other people. So we need to find the money somewhere.
And vice versa, there are people in prison who shouldn't be in prison. Right.
Right. And who should be out.
Didn't something recently happen a few years ago where some sort of storage unit that had all this DNA sample was burnt down?
I'm not sure.
There was a massive warehouse fire. 30 years worth of evidence, including DNA, possibly destroyed an NYPD storage facility blaze. in 2022.
Whoa.
So that's really, that's tough because, you know, if anyone was trying to appeal their conviction and was relying on evidence that was stored there, it's gone.
That's literally insane. Okay, so you said that they decided to contact the three individuals, Carter,
James,
and Ted, who we really don't know much about personality-wise. Okay. Yeah.
So let's start with Carter. So Carter is tracked down, and he's cooperative. He didn't seem concerned about giving his DNA sample. He comes in, he's swabbed, and that's sent to the lab. James is also tracked down, and they are able to collect a DNA sample from him too, and was easy. Now, Ted is living in Buffalo, and they're able to get in touch with his sister, and it turns out that he's suffering from Alzheimer's.
Oh.
And has severe memory loss.
Wow.
So remember how I said he couldn't remember where he was?
Right.
The night before, yeah. In 1994? He may have had, like, early onset Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So basically, whoa, his family refused to give Ted's DNA sample.
Okay, so the cops can get it out of, like, a trash can that they, you know, garbage that they throw out.
True. I don't know if they went to that extent, but they did try several times to reach out to his family to get his DNA sample through a swab, and they were not able to do that. So without being able to possibly link Ted through DNA, detectives are now hoping that one of the three other men, Mason, Carter, or James, comes up as a match.
Okay. So process of elimination.
Yeah. And the lab actually gets a hit.
Oh.
The DNA did match one of the three. Who do you think it is?
Oh, man. Wait a minute. Wait. Where on her body is this DNA collected from?
Her vagina.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I can see Carter explaining that it was consensual sex that he had with his girlfriend. I'm gonna go with James, the short king, because he just seems like the least likely, which makes me feel like, is there something more there?
Well, you're actually right.
Oh, wow. Look at me. Send me to Jeopardy or something. Yeah, wow. Okay, wait a minute. It matches?
Mm-hmm.
Not the short king.
Yeah, so you know how I said detectives were able to retrieve James's DNA? Well, they were able to do that because his DNA was already in the database because he was serving time for an attempted rape on a woman.
Whoa.
Yeah. So that attempted rape happened 4 months after Cynthia's murder.
Oh. Okay.
Not only that, detectives also discovered that James did have an arrest record dating back to 1977, something that they were not able to uncover in 1994. And what the detectives on the show say is, listen, our database was different in 1994. We could look up crime that happened in Buffalo, but not necessarily New York City.
Oh, and that's where it was happening?
Yeah, James is not a Buffalo native, right? He's from New York City, New York. So the crimes happened in New York City. And they're crimes of sexual assaults against women. It even included manslaughter.
Wait a minute. Okay, I understand that maybe technology hadn't caught up yet, and it wasn't as simple as sending an email. But damn, could they send a fax to, like, different departments? And you know what I'm saying? Like,
right, yeah.
They could have sent a fax and just said, hey, this is what's going on. We just want to check, like, if these individuals have anything. Like,
yeah.
I don't, right? Like, I would think that that's
something that they would do, but
have you ever sent a fax before? I have.
Of course.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know. Have you ever used a floppy disk?
You got to ask someone that's like 20 this question.
True. That's true.
Okay. Like,
well, yeah. I mean, I'm sure people are listening to this and thinking of other methods they could have used, like, you know, just
mail.
Mail? Sending a letter? Sending someone down there, making the drive. Listen, the flight wasn't that bad. They could have put somebody on a plane.
Yeah.
And tickets were much cheaper. But I'm sure if you're law enforcement, you probably get like that stuff waived. You probably have to call a special number or something. If you're flying and it's crime related.
Yeah, I would think.
Or maybe there's like a special card. I don't know.
Yeah. It goes towards that. Yeah. But I agree. I feel like they could have done more.
Right.
But that's what they said as to why they didn't find his record and why they found Ted's. Because Ted is a Buffalo native.
Right.
So it was easy to find his record.
I'm kind of disappointed in the lack of police work that was done up to this part. Right? Because it doesn't seem like brain science to me. Especially if it's someone who's new to the area, I would ask them, where are you from? Like, where are you coming from? I need a reference, basically. Like, give me someone I could talk to. I don't know, but I would try to, like, just make sure I do my due diligence and check out places they've lived before.
Yeah, definitely.
Just to make sure I've crossed my T's and dotted my I's. I don't know. What do y'all think? Let us know in the comments. But I'm just perplexed by this.
So detectives go to visit James, who is serving time for this 1995 rape. And he's serving time in a psychiatric ward, actually, in upstate New York. They didn't tell James about the DNA match, but they're hopeful that he'll just confess. He goes on to tell the same story as day one, that he found the cabinet in his backyard. He called police. He's not sure how the cabinet got there. It wasn't there the night before. Someone placed it there when he was sleeping.
Maybe his alter ego did.
Maybe.
Here's my other question, though.
Mm-hmm.
Police, are they not the same officers investigating James for the rape, like for the 1995 rape? Like, what's going on with the disconnect between these offices if they're all in Buffalo, right? Like, this happened in Buffalo too, the 1995 one?
Yes. Yeah.
Are they not, like, just keeping track of people? Because it happened so fast, right? After her murder. You're telling me that you didn't, like, go back around to do, like, a second round of questioning and notice that James was in prison at that time? Like,
yeah.
It just doesn't make sense to me.
Even with Mason, you know, he was in the area. He raped 8 women.
Right.
You didn't think to look into that. I don't know to what extent they did look into it or didn't.
It sounds like they rushed everything right out the outset and kind of just threw their hands up when nothing seemed to stick.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like to me. Because again, the fact that James committed a crime so close in time and within proximity of the same area.
So James said that he does not know Cynthia. He never knew her. He did not murder her. And then they put the DNA report in front of him and he knew it was over.
Oof.
He couldn't explain how his DNA was found inside of Cynthia's body.
Yeah.
James finally confesses and he remarks, what's another 25 to life?
Oh, hell no. Not James, like Short King, who is shy and stuff, saying like, whatever. What?
Mm-hmm.
You see, you can never really know somebody.
Yeah.
I'm acting like I know him in real life. But it's like, you really, you know what I'm saying? Looks can be deceiving.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Because, like, wow, the balls to just say, what's another 25 years of life?
Yeah. Crazy.
Huh?
So what detectives believed happened that night of June 29th into the early morning of June 30th, 1994, based off of what James told them and the evidence that they collected, is that Cynthia goes out for some fresh air. James approached her during that walk, and before this, the two of them had never met before, right? Because James had just moved into the area. James tells detectives that they struck up a conversation because he was new to the neighborhood and Cynthia was just trying to be friendly, and she agreed to continue their conversation at his place. It's unlikely that she thought she was in danger, right? Because James is this tiny man. He's a little nerdy. He seems pretty nice, right?
Well, I'm wondering why she would go to his house if she doesn't know him. I guess, like, she might have been in a frazzled state from, like, leaving her place, and she's arguing with Carter, and she meets him, and he looks almost like this superhero.
Yeah, he, like, seems really nice and just, like, laid back and friendly and someone that she feels that she can trust.
Damn. We are too trusting, y'all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. And so she goes back to his house, but James clearly wanted more, and detectives believe that a struggle occurred sometime after. James then proceeds to stab Cynthia to death and brings her to his bathtub, where he tries to dismember her so that he could place her in the cabinet, but the knife was not sharp enough, right? So he was trying to cut through her neck. That wasn't working. He was trying to cut through her leg. That wasn't working. He just pretty much gave up and allowed her to bleed out and then shoved her as best as he could inside the cabinet after wrapping her in this green blanket. So they think that after he did that, he dragged the cabinet outside. And the next day, or possibly like later on that morning, right, when he calls Ted to come over, he plays it off like, oh my gosh, where did this cabinet come from? Let's move it to the side.
The audacity.
Mm-hmm. So Ted wasn't even in on it. See, like, you could have gotten someone wrapped up in something that they weren't even involved in.
Right.
It's crazy.
How did he even meet Ted if he just moved to town?
That never came up.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, Ted was helping him with renovations, right? It could be that, like, his family, his relatives knew someone, like a handyman, to help with renovations. Around 2 years later, on June 12, 2012, nearly 18 years after her murder, James pleads guilty to second-degree manslaughter and is sentenced to 23 years to life without the possibility of parole. So something that the show didn't mention, but I read in an article from Buffalo News, is that according to his defense attorney, James is borderline mentally retarded. This is, quote, he said this, he can't read or write, and therefore he doesn't take responsibility for his actions. Because basically he's not capable of doing that.
You know, for the rape charge from the Buffalo area as well, James was in a psych ward.
So he served time in prison, but I think after he was going to be released, the judge ordered a civil confinement order. The judge was able to do that because James was determined to have a mental abnormality, basically, and he was too great of a risk to be let out. So I looked up what a civil confinement order is, and this basically means that an individual may be subject to involuntary civil commitment if they pose a threat to themselves or others, or if they are unable to provide for their basic needs due to their mental illness. So this is something that the judge could order, but there is a process where there is a hearing, you have right to counsel, there are periodic judicial reviews. So of course, you could challenge it if you felt like you are capable of being outside. But still, it's just going to be a constant review from the board to see, like, okay, are you capable of being out in public? Do you pose a threat? If you're not able to basically show that you're not a threat, you're going to still be confined. So that was basically his circumstance in 2010.
Did his lawyer try to put forth an insanity defense?
They didn't say, but I think that based off of the statement that was made to Buffalo News, that it was implying that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to prove insanity.
Yeah. You don't understand what you're doing and you don't realize that it's wrong.
Right. Those are the two prongs for the insanity defense.
Yeah.
under McNaughton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be argued that that is the case, but I think the prosecution could argue, like, well, he had the mindset to try to dismember her.
Yeah.
Right? He had the mindset to put her outside and then devise this plan where he wrapped up Ted, who has early onset Alzheimer's probably at that point,
mm-hmm.
and tries to trick Ted. So I could see how the prosecutors could just, like, dislodge that insanity defense, like, very quickly.
Yeah.
Was Carter shocked to hear, or was her family shocked to hear that it was James?
They were definitely shocked to hear that it was James, but also relieved that James was caught, because during this past 18 years that had passed, they were living in constant fear that he might strike again. And also just wanting justice for her sister.
Right.
Another thing about James that Roxanne actually mentioned in this article is that she was told that James was molested when he was young, but she said that does not excuse his violent behavior. We all know the difference between right and wrong. That's what she said. And I agree with that. Again, as to his mental abnormality, I don't know the extent of it.
Right.
Right? So, as a reasonable person, you should know right from wrong, but I don't know to what extent James knew right from wrong.
Mm.
But I just think, based on the current conviction as to the murder of Cynthia, the judge felt that he should have known, or rather that he understood right from wrong in sentencing him to 23 years to life without the possibility of parole.
Right.
So, yeah, either way, I just felt that was important for me to share about James. As far as Cynthia's family, obviously they are deeply saddened by all of this. And Roxanne made a statement to this Buffalo News that we thank God for allowing us to have our sister for 29 years.
Mm.
But I couldn't find anything on her kids or any updates from Roxanne either.
What about the attorney general? Because he probably was punching the air that it wasn't Mason. So Mason did get out of prison. Did Mason end up committing additional crimes?
Nothing comes up under Mason Sanderson. So it's possible that they gave a different name. I'm not really sure why they would do that.
Yeah,
because he was convicted.
I don't think they would. No. I think sometimes what happens is, like, especially with news articles from, like, the 90s, it's not, like, it's uploaded online, but sometimes it's not even really accessible. You got to go to a library and do all kinds of stuff to look into the archives and stuff. I would just be interested to know if Mason went on to commit additional crimes like the attorney general thought, or if he was able to actually turn his life around.
I mean, after raping 8 women, I have a hard time thinking how you could turn your life around, but you know, you never know.
Right? You never know.
God can do miracles.
Some time in prison, and when people in prison know that you are a rapist, I mean, it might change your mind, I guess, you know?
Very true.
It's not an easy existence.
Yeah, but that's a case of Cynthia Epps.
That really sucks, and I know Carter must feel horrible about the fact that she walked out during an argument and was murdered as a result.
Yeah.
Like, huh?
Well, it was never clear whether they were having an argument. I think he made it seem like she was just going out for a walk and he gave her a hug goodbye.
But like, also, see you later. I'm sure he's thinking to himself, why would I allow her, a woman that I love, to walk alone outside in the dark?
I don't know if this was a normal routine for her. I wish that there was a little bit more information on Cynthia. Because maybe she does go for walks all the time. And this was just...
At night, though, like...
I used to go for walks at night.
I don't know why you would do that.
Sometimes the sun just sets, like, really fast.
Exactly.
And it's 7 p.m.
But you're usually coming inside as it's getting dark.
No, I used to go outside as it was getting dark. I don't do that anymore.
Okay, that's not what you should be doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's not what we recommend for people to do. Listen, things happen in the daytime too, but
yeah,
you definitely should not be going out alone, walking, running, whatever, at night. Because look, James looked super unsuspecting, right? Yeah. And who would have thought the short king would do, well, he's not even a king. I don't know what to call him. Mm-hmm. But it ain't that. Whatever Scar was in The Lion King is what he is. Because Scar was not he wasn't the king, and that's why he killed Mufasa. Like, he really wanted to be king.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, anyways, I think there's a few takeaways. Number one, looks can be deceiving.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they look like a nice person and this and that doesn't mean that's who they truly are. And number two, do not go out in the dark walking by yourself. You shouldn't honestly even be walking by yourself in the daytime. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the kind of world we live in, though. Like,
yeah,
that you have to be on your P's and Q's, and you got to keep your head on a swivel, you know, during all times. But especially at night, don't do it. Just be careful, because we live in a world that's just full of crazy people who do crazy things.
Yeah, it's definitely unfortunate that you can't go outside for a walk. And I don't know. I know it's at night, but it's just sad that there's so many evil human beings out there with just terrible intentions.
And I feel like the evil is concentrated more so in the U.S. because I think I was looking at a TikTok about women in Norway who leave their babies outside to sleep in the cold. And they're not afraid of anyone attacking their child or taking their child, because they're like, that literally just doesn't happen here. So I'm like, maybe the United States is the issue. Maybe I gotta move to Norway. Honestly. Let us know in the comments if you guessed right and you thought it was James, or did you think it was Carter or Ted, who didn't have a personality, but now we know it's because he had onset Alzheimer's. That's not why he didn't have a personality, but I'm saying, like, now we finally know something about him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that concludes this week's episode of It's the Mystery for Me. Tune in. Not next week, but the week after, for another new episode. Just be careful out there, y'all. This episode has showed us a lot. It has showed us to be very careful about our surroundings and also not to be too trusting of people.
Yeah.
And I think it just feeds into Norma's theory some more about why she doesn't like short kings. You know, like, we need
a what? You're right.
We need to change the narrative, but... anyways, but that's that. See you guys very soon. Bye.
Bye, guys.